time shortly. You're good.
On this episode of the Tech Stack, we're talking with Red Hat and their perspective on virtualization in the Red Hat AI space, coming up next. Hi, everyone. This is Mark Bina with Smart Tech Research. I'm coming together with Dave Altavilla from Hot Hardware, talking with Red Hat, Stu Miniman's Red Hat, who handles the a variety of areas in the strategy area. We're excited to talk to him. The virtualization space is a huge area of interest. Love to have him. We're so excited that he's on the podcast today. So, Stu, let me let you introduce yourself.
Thanks, Mark. Stu Miniman, as you mentioned, I'm with Red Hat. I'm a senior director here at Red Hat, and this month actually celebrating 5 years at Red Hat. It's crazy. Joined about 6 months into the pandemic and blinked, and here I am. I had a long relationship with Red Hat over 20 years ago. I was at a storage company, y'all might remember, EMC. And when I started as a young product manager, they're like, hey, you're doing this networking and some other stuff and helping up with a few things. There's this Linux stuff that we're trying to get to work with the enterprise, and it's a total nightmare. Here's one engineer. Why don't you work on it? And thankfully, like almost 2 years later, Red Hat came out with Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which solved our problem. I worked with them when I was an analyst for a decade. And when the cloud native stuff really exploded, I'd worked with them a lot, especially their OpenShift team. And that's the group I ended up joining. So
nice. So that's senior great. Director of Market Insights, hybrid platforms at Red Hat. Yeah. That sounds like a little bit of work for sure. What's your purview in the company? What are you tasked?
Sure thing, Dave. I'm in the technical marketing group in our business unit. So hybrid platform, it's OpenShift, OpenStack, virtualization, those kind of pieces. So, you know, my background heavily is infrastructure, and, you know, we're that layer of, you know, we used to kind of call it PaaS, you know, containers, Kubernetes, everything like that. Virtualization obviously plays into it. My team is tech marketing for our security management products. I've got the competitive team for OpenShift. And personally, I meet with a lot of customers. I'm based outside of Boston and our global briefing center's there. So love meeting with customers, hearing what they're doing, helping them understand their cloud strategy, their vert strategy, getting things ready for their AI strategy. And I talked to a lot of analysts since I spent a decade doing that role myself.
We're sorry about that, Stu.
Yeah, you know, it's we can all debate which is the dark side, working on the vendor side or working on the analyst side. It all depends on how you look at things.
There might be darkness on either side. You know, the darkness can be shared.
Absolutely.
So
good stuff. Good stuff for sure. You want me to field the first question for Stu? Are we going to
You know, Dave, before you jump into it, let me just ask, let's do a quick question, you know, in addition to the questions we're going to get in front of you, Stu. Full disclosure, I worked for IBM 100 years ago as an intern and as a full-time employee back in the 80s, early 80s, when IBM announced the PC. That's a separate podcast by itself. The question I have for you is that IBM has had a long history of acquiring companies. Yeah. And Red Hat has been extremely successful working under the IBM umbrella. Yeah. And I've talked to a number of IBMers, some that have left IBM, have gone to Red Hat. Give me your perspective on why the Red Hat acquisition has worked out. I have my theories. I've heard feedback from certain people, but you've been there now for 5 years.
Yeah.
Why has Red Hat succeeded under IBM's auspices?
Yeah, Mark, it's a great one. And one that, you know, I know when I was in the outside, we looked closely at it. It was one of the things I looked really closely at before I joined, because like you, you know, I'd worked with IBM my entire career, right? You know, when I was at EMC, they were our biggest competitor and one of our biggest partners. When I was an analyst, you go to the IBM shows, you cover the IBM technologies, you know, everything from, you know, the Z to, you know, what they were doing with in the AI space in the early days. First of all, you know, Arvind was the one that architected the acquisition of Red Hat. I had the opportunity to talk to him a few times in some of his various roles. And when they bought Red Hat, sitting on the outside, it was like, There's a unique culture and it's kind of special. And while IBM has history with open source, I mean, I remember when they put $1 billion into Linux, back, many, many years ago. But, Red Hat, another acquisition that will get sucked in, but they put Arvind in as CEO. And one of the reasons they put Arvind in as CEO is you made this acquisition, you will make sure that it succeeds. And the main way they've done that is we are a wholly owned subsidiary of IBM. So, I'm sitting here, with a Red Hat logo. My benefits are Red Hat. My internal stuff's all Red Hat. IBM is our most important partner, but if you talk to most of us at Red Hat and you say, are you IBM employees? And you're like, well, we're Red Hat employees. We keep an eye on the IBM stock. We partner with them in a lot of areas, especially on the AI activity over the last couple of years. But we are still separate. And even 5 years in, it's an interesting discussion because, if we'll talk a little bit about AI, some of the really cool stuff that happened in the AI space came to Red Hat from the IBM research team. And there's been a little bit of, what pieces get moved into IBM, what pieces from IBM come into Red Hat. But we are still, a separate organization. We're over 20,000 employees now. The last number they shared, you've seen, we're over $6.5 billion worth of revenue when we were at around $3 billion when we got acquired, and those were all public numbers. So, I get to watch IBM's earnings like everybody else and be like, oh, cool. Hey, I can now share certain metric numbers because, Arvind or the CFO went and talked about them. But right. Yeah, Mark, we are still, and I'll tell you internally, Red Hat is even more Red Hat on the inside. So we're constantly debating like what's happened to our culture and are we staying true to our mission of open source and everything we've done? And I've worked at a number of different companies. Red Hat's still special and IBM is trying to make sure that we still can do our mission.
Now that's a great answer. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was going to say it is great insight and don't mess with success, as they say. Right. So
it's proof positive that a technology acquisition can be successful and IBM management should be applauded for not fooling around with, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
Mark, it's funny. We're going to talk a little bit about virtualization. I was one of the first people at EMC working with VMware pre-acquisition. So I watched the partnering with VMware, acquiring VMware, was there for another 7 years and then covered them as an analyst. So the ins and outs of VMware and who owned them and spun them out and, reacquired and, the implications of that, a very different case study than what we've seen, at least in the first 5 years of IBM buying Red Hat.
Yeah, absolutely. And that you're a great straight man because you just teed up my first question actually with that. Speaking of virtualization, and we'll add this to the stage real quickly, Red Hat's impact on virtualized systems. You folks are best known for enterprise grade, open source, Linux based software, right? But the company has a long history in virtualization. Walk us through Red Hat's journey into this space and how Red Hat differentiates, where you came from, and I guess where you're going moving forward.
Yeah, it is a really interesting one. And I got a lot of history on this one. As I mentioned, over 20 years ago, I started working with VMware. Funny thing, it was actually the Linux device drivers that got me involved because those same device drivers that we got to work to make Linux work and were things that got baked into things like Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Underneath VMware ESX, which of course predated ESXi, it was some of those same device drivers. There was a little bit of work that needed to be done, but we don't think about the fact that some of the underlying components of VMware's virtualization were Linux in the early days. And even I was doing some double checking this morning, getting ready for this. Yeah, there's still some components in there that are Linux based, even though of course, VMware is proprietary technology. But that actually predated virtualization in the open source world and for what Red Hat did. It was about in 2007 when the KVM hypervisor came out, and that, of course, got baked into Linux. So you talked about Red Hat Enterprise Linux. KVM became part of our offering, and we created at Red Hat a fully open source stack. Red Hat virtualization, it went through as RHEV and then RHV, Red Hat Enterprise Virtualization, or just Red Hat Virtualization. It did okay in the market, but VMware really had a stranglehold on, you know, the enterprise data center. What was interesting to really watch is that KVM technology being open source became the de facto hypervisor for a lot of environments. If you look at the public cloud, most of the public clouds, their virtualization layer is KVM. Now, they didn't buy it from Red Hat. They just used the open source technology, but it shows the kind of maturity and the scale of deployment of that technology all around the world in so many environments. That underlying KVM technology then also moved into the OpenStack era. So around 2012, a lot of the engineers at Red Hat that were working on the virtualization technology went and worked on the OpenStack components. We had a lot of success with that, especially in telecommunications. All the networking companies really use that, quite a bit, and building some private clouds around the world. And then as the cloud native ecosystem kind of exploded, Red Hat and many others looked at, hey, while containers are great, we still think there's going to be some need for virtual machines. So they said, how can we bridge between the virtualization world and the containerized world? And that's where the open source project KubeVirt came from, which just allows us to take that proven KVM hypervisor and pull it into a pod so that I can use the same cloud native tooling and management and orchestration that I do from containers with virtual machines. And that was in 2016 that the project launched. And we added that as a feature fully baked into OpenShift by 2020. That's OpenShift virtualization, just a feature of OpenShift. So we've now had that in our portfolio, generally available now for 5 years.
Wow. So VMs and containers living together like cats and dogs, no problem.
Yeah. I mean, Dave, you know, we know how it is in tech. You know, I remember in the early days, you know, I was going to conferences and they'd be like, oh, you know, containers will rule the world and everybody, you know, throw out your mainframes, throw out your virtual machines and everything. I went to an IBM conference and I met with, you know, one of the largest retailers in the world. And they're like, hey, yeah, we're running Docker containers on our mainframe and we do really cool. Oh, and we're also using OpenStack there. And it was like, oh, cool. All of these things live side by side. One of my maxims, when I was an analyst is like, come on, we all know no technology ever dies. It's always additive. Right. We'd like to retire some things, but we know things build and grow and mature and change over time.
Makes sense. Yeah, absolutely. By the way, noticing the Empire gear and maybe Mandalorian gear behind you. That's good stuff, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, the limited edition, the Crimson Stormtrooper one, definitely it plays in well with kind of the Red Hat theme.
Excellent. Excellent. It does indeed. It does indeed. Mark, you've got some burning questions too. Why don't you go ahead and fire away, buddy?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, Stu, when you look at the customers that you deal with, you deal with all day long, sure, as these enterprises are modernizing their infrastructure, are they absolutely? You know, you hinted at it. Actually, you said it pretty directly. When you talk about supporting both hybrid and multi-cloud environments, is that just a must-have? I mean, is it table stakes from your perspective?
Yeah. Great point, Mark. So it's interesting. So at Red Hat, we're over a decade into talking about, being the infrastructure for the hybrid environment. And how many years did we have, we were talking about technologies taking over. Oh, it's all going to the cloud. It's like, okay, for a lot of years, how does Red Hat help you in the cloud? Well, our Linux, our containerization, cloud native architecture, we can run that across many clouds, across your data center, and across edge environments. And that resonated with what we saw for most of our customer base, because while the cloud is great, I still had things in my data center. And spoiler alert, what is AI doing? AI is actually driving a lot of customers to think about not only the data at the edge, but maybe there's certain environments that I want to, wrap my arms around my data, really control it, get a handful of GPUs and keep that in my data center because I want to make sure that I've, got everything secure. Of course, the cloud can be secure, but, especially for certain regulated industries and government agencies, they want the data center. So it's funny. I found the last 3 years, oh my God, like the data centers are hot again. We can spend another half hour talking about repatriation or things like that. But at the end of the day, they're spending money in the cloud. They're spending money in the data center. AI is a driving conversation force for, pretty much every customer I've talked to in the last 2 years. And oh, architecturally speaking, do VMs play a role in that? Yes, but you know, if I have some data from our friends over at Gartner, and they said, you know, by 2028, 95% of new AI applications are going to run containers. So it's one of those things that like, hey, do you hold on to your VMs? Yeah, absolutely. Like, we've been working on this modernization journey for a decade. Not every application does it make sense to modernize, and sometimes it will take time. But as you get ready for the new stuff, how do we make sure that we balance that out? So, yeah, I mean, again, if no technology ever dies and everything gets additive, whether you're acquiring companies or you just have business units with different needs, the consistency that we can offer our solution everywhere is something that's played out from a Red Hat standpoint. It's why when we went, you know, from the Unix era to the Linux era, it's, oh, I have different servers and different applications. Oh yeah, Linux can run everywhere. Oh, now I need to run multiple clouds and data center and edge. Oh, OpenShift can help you with the containerization. And that's even our AI messaging is very similar, is your world's going to be heterogeneous. Trust, you know, the leaders in open source and helping to bring that across your environment, because we're going to play and we're going to do the deep engineering work to live in all of those environments.
Good stuff.
You know, it sounds like a Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. No technology ever dies. That's the next unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's talk about virtualization in the age of AI. I mean, you mentioned a couple of macro trends. I think you quoted a stat from Gartner there. You know, what are you seeing from the customer base? What are you hearing from the customer base about their changing needs and operating systems and tools, compute resource environments, all that stuff? I mean, it impacts everything, and you have to accommodate so much more, I would think.
Yeah, Dave, it's a tough one, because I tell you, I got a long history in the virtualization world. Technology works, people are happy with it, and there's the financial things that are making them say, wait, even though I don't really want to, maybe I need to consider my alternatives. So that's the conversation we've been having for the last 2 years for customers. And to be honest, most of them didn't realize how difficult it was to move off of them. I think Broadcom understood it. That's why they, you know, made the acquisition of VMware. And if it was something that people could just snap their fingers and leave them, it wouldn't be financially make sense. So Broadcom's made a lot of money. By the way, VMware's long been an important partner of Red Hat. What lives in a VM? It's only one of two things. It's Windows or Linux. We're the leader in Linux, and we have a lot of customers that ran, you know, Red Hat Enterprise Linux in VMs forever. OpenShift itself, the number one environment where that has lived for the longest time is on VMware environments. So we always make sure technically we work across those environments. VMware has been a super important partner. When we created KubeVirt, it wasn't to like displace virtualization. It was, hey, we've got this modern way of doing things. Maybe you might want to have some VMs into them.
Yeah.
The last couple of years, we've had customers that have called us up and said, help us. They're calling, you know, my CEO, Matt and Arvind, and they're saying like, hey, I've got a massive budget hit. You're an important partner of us. Can you help us? And that's where we actually had to accelerate some of the work we were doing to have it be virtualization isn't just like, oh, we have a couple of VMs here, but what if I need thousands or tens of thousands of VMs running in production in this same environment? Now, there were no technical limitations for us to doing it, but testing out that full environment, making sure we have the entire ecosystem with it, is something that we spent a lot of work over the last 18 months for. And, you know, anybody that knows that space, I mean, I lived through a decade of getting storage and networking working well with VMware. You know, people that remember, it was like, oh, in the early days, it was test dev. And then by the time we got to like, you know, ESX3, it was like most applications could run. By the time you got to, you know, vSphere 5, it was like the monster VMs, and I could even run my databases on it. So we've seen a similar journey, and we could accelerate that based on what we knew in the past. But yeah, it's been a lot of work, and we've been working with a ton of customers to give them that option if they wanted to either add it to their, you know, platform that they have for containerization, or if they needed that alternative to the VMware stack, where we, along with our partner ecosystems and all of our go-to-market partners, could help them with that migration. And again, it's not an overnight thing. A lot of customers, it's quarters, if not years of work to make sure you do it. And it's just from a risk standpoint, you know, these have been my mission critical environments. They're running real good. I can't just throw them over the wall and hope that everything works okay. You need to make sure we have a very, you know, very measured process as to how you move things and bring things up and run them in production. Because again, this has been running, you know, very important applications for decades for many customers.
Yeah. Yeah. Clearly IBM was paying attention when they picked you guys up.
it's funny. It was, you know, when you think about when IBM, you know, announced the acquisition, it was 2018.
Yeah.
Moving customers off VMware wasn't on, you know, our bingo card in 2018, yeah. 2019, 2020. It was years later. But I'll tell you, the thing that changed greatly is when you think about when Broadcom made the VMware announcement, mm-hmm. we'd never heard of ChatGPT. Right. So the budgetary impact of AI and what that's doing to our industry, we think is a compounding effect. And what I've seen is oftentimes you're talking to two different groups in a company, but when you're talking about general IT or the finance arm, you better be having those conversations together, because I have things I want to do and things that are pulling on the wallet strings. And if I don't balance those out, I might be in trouble.
And Stu, that's one of my follow-up questions here is that AI is the demand for AI is off the charts. And I think we're just at the beginning of this, by the way. It's off the charts now. Who knows what it's going to be like 3 to 5 years from now. How is it affecting the design requirements for virtualization platforms, you know, from a performance, call it an orchestration standpoint, resource allocation? What kind of feedback are you hearing, and what's your perspective on that, how it's changing that world?
Yeah, it's very different. Even if I look at, you know, our platform and the cloud native stack that we have, there's a lot of work going on to make sure that it can meet the needs and requirements of AI, because containerization in Kubernetes was very much built for distributed systems. You know, not every company is a Google, but I have my applications, you know, whether it's 12-factor applications or, you know, other type of applications, they have to live many different places. And if I look at most AI deployments, I train one place, I have inferencing somewhere else, I have mm-hmm. data that needs to be able to either be acted on where it has or move data in between. So it's not the traditional shove it in a VM, leave it there, and it doesn't change and it doesn't move. The world of AI is much more distributed and much more dynamic. So again, with my background, you know, in virtualization, it was mostly like, hey, my really stable environments, it was really good for. We talked about when cloud came out, it was, hey, if I have something that's growing and extracting and changing, it made sense to put it in the cloud. Well, for AI, you know, we're all saying, I don't know what it's going to look like in 12, 18, 24 months from now. But what we do know is things are changing a lot and applications need to be much more dynamic. That push for modernization that we've had for, I don't know, the last 10, 15 years is I need to be able to respond to my customers and the needs of the business. And AI is driving that even faster. And unfortunately, virtualization inherently has some limitations. Now we can accelerate that some by pulling it into a cloud native architecture, things like GitOps and pipelines and other solutions that we have can extend a little bit what I can do with virtual machines. But at the end of the day, a VM is a little bit heavy and containers were meant to be, you know, smaller, more agile, you know, live for a shorter period of time. And therefore architecturally, It's the reason why we feel we're pretty confident with that being our platform for the long term. And it will allow us to keep some virtual machines in that environment as need be. But containerization is much more fit. And by the way, you know, functions as a service, serverless type of stuff can play into that containerized world too. And something we've spent years working on with the Knative open source project.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting to think about, you know, models and how you package them up on the platform in containers, you know, seem like a natural fit for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark, you want to dive into OpenShift a little bit before we let Stu off the hook?
Yeah, that's that's Red Hat secret sauce. So let's talk about the impact of Red Hat OpenShift. It's obviously a very significant capability, Stu, for you folks. Let's talk about the value proposition. And again, as it maps out against AI, you know, this desire to unify different containers, not disrupt workflows, that's a big, big deal. And, you know, I'm sensing that OpenShift really is a great hedge against disrupting workflows. So let's give me a perspective of the value proposition around OpenShift.
Sure. Thanks, Mark. I talked a bit before containerization, Kubernetes, cloud native architectures. One of the things that really differentiates OpenShift from just taking Kubernetes and rolling it out there is we've really built a comprehensive application development platform. And you can get Kubernetes from a lot of environments out there, but there's a reason why the cloud companies, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, you know, partner with us to be able to offer our offering in the cloud as well as what they have too. And it's because we take all of the cloud native tooling that you need to be able to build, manage, and operate your applications, not just kind of the bare the orchestration itself underneath that. So OpenShift itself, cloud native application platform, and as I said, it can not only support your containers, it can support your virtual machines, it can support serverless type of applications, and it has years of working on AI applications itself. So we've got customers that have been using it, you know, for 5-10 years for predictive AI. And of course, in the last couple of years, generative AI also can live on this environment. Mm-hmm. OpenShift itself also is the substrate for the Red Hat AI tools. And by the way, even those pieces are the underpinning for our friends at IBM, the Watson X offerings that they have. So again, you know, that platform that you build on, you know, at the end of the day, the people that, you know, buy these platforms, it's infrastructure. What really matters to me, it matters my applications, my data. How do I extract the value out of that? How do I create new business value for my customers and my partners? And OpenShift has over 10 years of proven delivery in that environment. Our friends at IBM shared we're over $1.7 billion worth of ARR. And we're really not only one of the growth engines of Red Hat, but you know, one of the key pieces that fit into the IBM portfolio. Because as I said, not only were some of the AI pieces, but even architecturally, we fit into the front end of what IBM is doing on the quantum computing. So it's one of those, if you don't know infrastructure and don't care about some of these architectures, you wouldn't necessarily know OpenShift, but our customers are who's who of the financial institution, government institution, healthcare and medical and the like. So it's been awesome, you know, working at Red Hat. One of the things I'm most proud of and always love talking to customers, but, you know, we have, last I checked, I think we've got over 250 public references of our customers that use our technology. And if you go to any of the big conferences, not only our conference, but like the KubeCon, Cloud Native Con, our customers are often sharing what they're doing, using our technology, and sometimes even contributing to the technology. Because of course at Red Hat, we are not just, you know, users of open source, we are paragons of contributing to the community. And we want more people to contribute to open source. So we help our competitors, our partners, and even our customers contribute to open source to be able to make a flourishing ecosystem, which is even more important in the AI era, because we want to make sure that everything we've built on and open source is the default for software development today. And we think that will continue deeply into the AI world. And when we're concerned about things like security, open source needs to be, you know, front and center in that kind of conversation.
Yeah. So, I mean, you guys literally are, I mean, I guess you could think of you as the connective tissue here for all of these new platforms, all of this new technology coming into the market. You mentioned quantum. That's a mind-bending technology in and of itself, of course. What's the role there for you folks? It must be decidedly different in how you.
Yeah, David, it's an interesting one. I am no expert at quantum, but I was talking to some of my architects on this, and it's where quantum computing needs to be able to connect to traditional infrastructure that we live in front of that. So, you know, the architecture there. So again, it was something, I don't know whether IBM fully had put all the pieces together when they acquired us, but when I heard about that connection, I was like, well, hey, that makes even more sense, because if you look at, you know, IBM's future and the growth, of course, AI and quantum are going to get, you know, a lot of the conversation there. And what we're doing at Red Hat with their recent acquisition of HashiCorp, should be able to help with, you know, all of these heterogeneous environments, and how do we get all of these technologies to work together? Because, you know, that's the hard work, is, you know, just keeping this consistently up and running to be able to deal with the ever-changing world that happens. And as I said, Red Hat, we've been doing that for over 30 years now. You know, I was a big fan of Hashi, you know, before I joined Red Hat, and was super happy to see them, you know, in the larger family there.
Good stuff. So connective tissue in traditional architectures and connective tissue perhaps into the quantum realm. I mean, just it's wild to think about that, but that makes perfect sense. You know, you have to interface to legacy architectures and to legacy infrastructure, and quantum is something very new and powerful. So yeah, good stuff for sure. Mark, what do you got before we let Stu off the hook here and wrap up, buddy?
Yeah, the one perspective I want to ask Stu about, and maybe maybe to combine two questions and two answers into one question, long question. Scalability for OpenShift. I think that's probably a big deal, especially as we go forward, because nobody knows where AI is going from a demand standpoint. We know that the arrow is pointing up, but beyond that, it would be interesting to get your perspective on the scalability piece. But the other topic that I'd love you to talk about here is maybe put your crystal ball on and hat on and say, hey, you know, where do you think the world is going? I know that's a hard one. You know, if everybody knew what was going to happen tomorrow, we will be rich betting on the Yankees winning the World Series. And that's so much fucking question. I know that opens up a can of worms with Dave. But nevertheless, want to get your perspective on those questions, the scalability piece, and maybe crystal ball your brain a bit.
Yeah, sure. So scalability, scale's a great one, because, you know, really, if you think about it at the core, what was Kubernetes meant to do was to help with that scalability. So, you know, I said before, not every company is Google, but it's nice to know that the technology came out of Google and can help with that scalability. Where it's been really interesting over the last few years, and where we spent a lot of effort on, is to really help in those edge environments, because while not every company is saying, oh, I need to run, you know, 100,000 servers and manage it all, we do have quite a lot of customers that say, hey, I've got 100 or maybe a couple of thousands of locations, and I need to be able to manage that. So we spent a lot of effort to be able to help Kubernetes get down to a really small footprint and be able to manage fleets of environments. So everything from fleets of drones to specialized work that we're doing in the automotive era, and think about like autonomous vehicles and what's needed there. So Kubernetes itself and all the work that we do from a management standpoint and the surrounding systems help a lot in the scalability of the solutions. And of course, observability is something that I need to have as I get to these really large environments where I wouldn't necessarily be able to look at every piece of technology and every single component of what's going on. So observability has been a big thing that both we partner with a lot of companies and the open source community is building onto it. Look, the future one is one we all love to debate about. The thing that what is really nice about our architecture is we're 100% built off on open source. So if you look at what we've done in the last 10 years, we try as much as possible to make sure that when some new open source component comes out, that it should be able to plug into this architecture. And eventually, if it makes sense, it might even just become a feature into our platform. We work really closely with an ever-growing ecosystem. We've got hundreds of ISVs out there that have worked in, you know, the open source community and can plug into this environment, and very much have the design thought that, you know, this should be able to be extensible with the APIs that we're doing. So it's a real balance. It's funny, the biggest push that we get from our customers is say, hey, I want to deploy something, and can I run it like your Linux and just keep it for 10 years? Whereas the same point, they're like, hey, I have a security fix that I need put in there, or there's a new function that I saw come out that sounds really awesome. Can you add that to my platform? So how fast do I update things and keep modern on it versus how long can I keep an extended life cycle? Today, we give, you know, our enterprise customers that are on long-term support 3 years of support of OpenShift. And we're always looking at, you know, do we need to extend that, and does that make sense? So it's funny. It's that balance, as you said, you know, what's the new technology and how can I take advantage of it? Where at the same time, customers are like, oh my gosh, can I just leave this for a while? I'm tired of, you know, chasing the rabbit on some of these new things. So it's both at the same time. Architecturally, we think, you know, the platform, the community has done a good thing there. And absolutely, we keep things going forward. I like to quote the old Andy Jassy line of, we try to keep the two-way doors and, you know, limit the one-way doors when we're making technology decisions. And for the most part, you know, our platform, we talk about it, it's batteries included, but optional and swappable to give you flexibility.
Wow. Yeah. No, hey, that's a lot. I mean, you folks are, you know, charged with working with a very wide ecosystem and a lot of variables in the future. So that takes a lot of horsepower from a software engineering standpoint, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. It was, I looked out, you know, I saw a presentation by our chief product officer, Shesh Badani, before I joined. And it was like, you know, there's like a million lines of new Linux code that comes out every month. And how do you keep up with that? And it's like, well, that's what Red Hat's got, you know, decades of experience with. We know the only constant in our industry is change. And, you know, Red Hat, we are built to be able to surf those waves of change and help customers, you know, make the best decisions that they can with what we've got.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Stu Miniman, Senior Director of Market Insights, Hybrid Platforms at Red Hat. Thank you so much for your time today. It was fascinating to catch up with you.
Awesome. Dave and Mark, great chatting. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for your time.
Yes. And with that, we will bid you adieu, folks. Hit thumbs up and subscribe, if you will, on this video. Great insights from folks like Stu at Red Hat and more coming down the pipe on the tech stack. And until the next time, we thank you very much, and we'll see you on the next tech stack.